Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's time now for War Telescope, presented weekly at this time by the NBC News and Special Events Department. But first, a word of warning from your government. Our transportation system today is facing a serious problem. The demands are increasing while the number of employees are decreasing. And now that D-Day has been proclaimed, tons of supplies and millions of men are being shipped to the new theaters of war in the Far East. The railroad and bus lines are working overtime, and there would be a complete breakdown if the already heavy loads were increased. Therefore, your government asks you to help avert this crisis. This year, spend your vacation at home. Not only will you be helping the war effort, but yourself as well, for traveling now will cause you a lot of discomfort. So don't travel. It's the patriotic thing to do. Now for today's War Telescope, we take you to NBC in Paris.
This is Paul Archinard in Paris with a sidelight on prison life in Germany. The prison life of a civilian in a military camp. You turn up as a ghost before a friend who has identified your naked dead body is an experience that very few men ever encounter. Mr. Lyle Foster of Ottumwa, Iowa, who is American Red Cross field director with the 99th Division, went through just that experience. When he was liberated from a German prison camp on April 29th, an officer of the 9th Division paled with surprise when he found a man who had been listed as dead. As the other American Red Cross, the only American Red Cross official or member ever to be taken prisoner in the European theater of war, Mr. Foster has many edifying tales to tell. He was captured with other members of the 99th Division during the Battle of the Bulge on December 17th of last year. And during his 4 months of detention, he was forced to change camps 9 different times, sometimes traveling by boxcar from one camp to another, most often hiking with other prisoners. On the day of their capture, 17 officers of the 99th and Red Cross Field Director Foster were lined up in front of a German firing squad, and their fate was debated during a half hour of wakeful anguish. Nazi armbands were given them as blindfolds, but fortunately, these were not needed. At the last minute, they were spared. Naturally, he was questioned. He was questioned as to whether he possessed any military information and was knocked down for refusing to tell what he did not know. But since we have Field Director Lyle Foster in the studio, we shall now let him speak for himself. Mr. Foster, I understand that you came up several times for repatriation. Do you know why you were refused?
Yes. In each of the 9 camps, I was in such bad physical condition that the medical commission advised repatriation. But I believe I was refused because I had seen too much of the brutal treatment of prisoners and the complete disregard of the Geneva Convention. Then, too, the Nazis didn't want the International Red Cross to know my whereabouts. And twice, when International Red Cross representatives came through the camp, I was put in solitary confinement until they had left.
Well, what had you seen that the Germans wouldn't want reported?
A great deal. Every day, the cruelty we suffered became more barbaric. One day, for instance, the German hospital guard ordered the patient in the bed next to mine to get up. Since he was too weak to move, he was bayoneted. Naturally, changing camps 9 times in 5 months meant a lot of moves. Every time we moved, dozens of men died. We usually traveled on foot, sometimes packed into boxcars. This meant going without food and water for days at a time. During one of our trips, I found myself half supporting an American officer. The boy had died in my arms during the night.
What were the general living conditions in the camps?
They were terrible. Our daily food ration was 1/12 of a loaf of bread and some soup. At first, I scraped the worms and the maggots off the soup. After a while, I ate them. I figured they were just so much meat. We saw few American Red Cross food parcels. The average weight loss was 50 pounds. I lost 58. My hands and feet were frozen, and I'm still walking with a cane. In the hospitals, Allied prisoners served as doctors and medics. Medical supplies were scarce. What little we got came from the International Red Cross.
And how was the morale of the prisoners?
It's not easy to be cheerful under prison conditions, because Red Cross field directors have been friends and advisors to all American troops. The men turned to me for assistance. Enlisted men working outside the camp managed to forage a few potatoes, some cabbage and turnips, and often shared the little they found with me. In March, spearheading tanks broke through to open our gates. Liberation was in sight, but most of us were too weak to escape. Almost immediately, the Germans regained control.
Did the Germans keep any of the terms of the Geneva Convention on treatment of prisoners?
Yes, we had the feeling that the officers were being held for use as hostages, but they were exempted from work, according to the convention. That is the reason we were not allowed to gather wood for fuel, and yet we needed the fuel.
Mr. Foster, you said that you had a feeling that officers were held for use as hostages. What made you come to that conclusion?
There were 27,000 officers in the camp. We had been moved back farther and farther into Germany as the Allies advanced. All along the route, they showed little regard for human life, especially for the enlisted men. Why, in Hunningen, where I was captured, I saw 40 of our enlisted men and two officers walk down the street waving a white flag. SS troops mowed them down with rip guns. Everywhere, enlisted men were killed indiscriminately. The officers fared a little better.
Thank you, Mr. Foster, and Godspeed on your journey back home. And there are many going back with you. American prisoners, Kriegs, as they are called over here, are coming into Paris by the hundreds, are gathering even now at ports of embarkation by the thousands. You folks at home will soon be seeing them again to hear their stories at first hand. And now here is Roy Porter.
This is Roy Porter in Paris. 5 years of occupation have ended for the people inside the German pockets along the Atlantic coast of France. Pockets which were bypassed during the rapid advance through France and into Germany, and which were left far behind because they themselves were not dangerous to the main objective of the Allied army. It happened mostly this week. The surrender of the garrisons at La Rochelle, which cleared the port of Bordeaux, the capitulation at Lorient, and at Saint-Nazaire, one of the largest harbors and shipbuilding yards in France. The surrender at Dunkirk, scene of the Allied retreat in 1940, and where there scarcely remains any indication that there was once an important city on the Channel. And finally, the Channel Islands of Guernsey and Jersey. The job was thoroughly and completely done. And for these pockets, 5 years of occupation have come to an end. There are some interesting details on the surrenders in these various places. I've just come back from the Atlantic coast, where I went to see the capitulation of Saint-Nazaire, and where, incidentally, a young American Air Force captain, Bill Brucker of East Hartford, Connecticut, and I were asked if we would receive the surrender of the German commandant and his 27,000 men. We refused because we didn't know what the arrangements were. And so the next day, they all turned themselves over to the French and the Americans. That brought to a finale one of the greatest stories of resistance in all of France, the defense of the pocket of Saint-Nazaire, a city which no longer exists. A city which had a former population of 45,000 and now has about 1,600. The mayor of Saint-Nazaire, with whom I had dinner night before last, says, however, that there is one good thing about his city. The shipyards have not been too badly damaged. And as soon as workers can be found, plus raw material, production can be resumed. These are the same yards where such ocean liners as the Île-de-France and the Normandy were built, and whose last big job was the construction of the French battleship Jean Bart. The German submarine pens, both at Saint-Nazaire and Lorient, are still there. Damaged, yes, but not knocked out, despite the terrific bombings they underwent. In Saint-Nazaire, there are still 3 U-boats, one of them very badly broken up, plus a German hospital ship. Battleshell is almost completely intact, ready to go to work as soon as any opportunity presents itself. On the opposite side, the port of Le Verdun, where so many Americans sailed away from Europe in the early months of the war in 1939, is almost completely demolished, primarily by aerial bombardment, and what our bombs didn't knock out, our artillery did. The German admiral who was in command of La Rochelle, his name is von Schirlitz, told French emissaries the day before the surrender was announced, "I will never surrender," and then changed his mind overnight. And the schoolboys in La Rochelle told the story about the day before the surrender, which was the only time in 5 years that they ever saw the chief of the Gestapo smile. He smiled all day long, at children, at the girls, at old people, at the monuments and at the sun, they tell me. We hope that no one will pay any attention to those smiles, which came too late. And then there's the story of the surrender of the Channel Islands, Guernsey and Jersey. Another account of German efforts to resist capitulation to the end, with all the arrogance and insolence of the German military machine. When a young German lieutenant was sent on board His Majesty's ship Bulldog to negotiate surrender terms with British officers far above him in rank and experience, and of how he was sent back for a major general named Heine, who himself accepted unconditional surrender. And later in the day, a German tug put into a French port on the Normandy coast, bringing back a group of British soldiers who had been captured by the Germans in a commando raid only 6 weeks ago, plus 39 American naval officers and men who had been held on the island of Guernsey. These are all stories of what happened this week at the end of the occupation, but they don't begin to tell the real occupation. These ports and the two islands were strategic to prevent us from moving in the equipment we needed to defeat them on the continent. They were partly right, and except for our reorganized supply system, which functioned far beyond expectations to other ports, we might have been short. Shorter than we were at times, although the Germans didn't know it. Now these ports are needed for additional shipping. Supplies of food coming from all parts of the world into Europe, and supplies for our own 16th Army of Occupation. And they're needed as well to clear hundreds of thousands of men from Europe to the United States, a part of them bound for the Pacific. One of the curious things about these 5 years of occupation, the Germans and the inhabitants will tell you the same story, has been the problem of food inside these districts. The civilians and the Germans both had about the same amount of trouble getting enough to eat. And when the Germans didn't get it, they took it away from the civilians. And when the civilians had it, they hid it away from the Germans. In several instances, the Germans mined airfields along the coast to prevent Allied planes from coming in. And then they had to have all the mines removed so that their own planes could get in with supplies for them. And at San Nazaire, there were nightly airdroppings of food and ammunition in specially built containers with parachutes attached. And still there wasn't enough to go around. The Germans in these port districts had established a fine mail service, 3 days from Germany and the same time back. But they themselves don't know where the planes came from because the pilots were under strict orders not to reveal their takeoff field. The story of the occupation would not be complete without the story of resistance. French resistance which kept the Germans ever fearful and which accounted for a number of German lives which it is impossible to estimate. Now the ports are cleared and the islands reoccupied. The last recorded act of resistance was near San Nazaire when a German foraging party tried to snatch a cow away from a farm. There was a short burst of machine gun fire and there were 3 more dead Germans. This is Roy Porter in Paris returning you to the United States.
Now from the United States, a glance at the latest news highlights. There's another rumor today about Heinrich Himmler. A roundabout report that he may be in British hands, delivered to the Allies by Hitler's successor, Admiral Dönitz. It's entirely unconfirmed. On the Czech front, Russian tanks still are hitting Nazi diehards who are trying to surrender instead to the Americans. And fire spreaders are causing the Russians some trouble in Berlin. U. Marshal Montgomery made a triumphal visit to Copenhagen today, while the Allies speed up the dismantling of German forces in Norway. There's been a high Allied strategy meeting in China, while a new American offensive on southern Okinawa wears on through the second day of bitter fighting. That's the War Telescope for today.